Ruth chapter 1, verses 6 through 14. Then she arose with her daughter-in-law, that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread. Therefore she went out from the place where she was, her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "Surely we will return with you and to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I even have hope, if I should have a husband tonight and should also bear sons, would you wait for them till they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her.
About a month ago, I introduced you to a Hebrew word, and I'm going to read you the definition of that word, and we're going to see if you remember the word. Oh, these looks. The definition is this: when the person from whom I have a right to expect nothing gives me everything. Speak. Hesed. Give the man a round of applause, would you? The Hebrew word is hesed. When the person from whom I have a right to expect nothing gives me everything, that's the word hesed. It's a unique word. It's unique in the sense that there's no other language that can capture all of the meaning of that one word with one word. The word hesed captures all of the positive attributes of God. It speaks of his love. It speaks of his kindness. It speaks of his grace. It speaks of his generosity. It speaks of his faithfulness. It's all caught up in that one word, hesed. In fact, when Miles Coverdale was translating the Hebrew Old Testament into the English language, and by the way, that's the first time that was done, we're talking the 1500s here, he could not find an English word that captured the meaning of hesed, so he made one up. He took two words that we already knew in English, put them together, and it came out as loving kindness. Isn't that a beautiful word? And that was his invention, and that's where the word came from. Because he couldn't find a word to adequately express hesed, he created the word loving kindness. And then he was the one who came up with that masterful translation of Psalm 63:3. Says, "Thy loving kindness is better than life." Well, it's thy hesed is better than life. It's hard to capture that in one word, but that's what hesed is all about. I told you it makes its way throughout the book of Ruth. We'll be seeing it time and again. I just don't want to get too far from your brain. This morning, we're going to see the loving kindness of God, and then we're going to see Naomi's response to that loving kindness, and then that response is going to create a dilemma for her daughters-in-law. So we'll see the dilemma for the daughters-in-law. So let's start with the loving kindness of God. In the text that Andrew just read, we see God's loving kindness displayed in three ways. First is in verse 6, and it's kind of in the middle of the verse where Naomi had heard in the country of Moab how the Lord had visited his people. Now that phrase, his people, is an important phrase here because it tells us that God is working with his covenant people, Israel. Israel had a relationship with God that was unique in all of the history of mankind. No other nation could ever claim to be God's covenant people. You know, I think that God has blessed the United States in some specific and wonderful ways, but we are not God's covenant people. We are what we are by the grace of God, but God hasn't bound himself in covenant with us like he bound himself in covenant with the Israelites. It's always risky when you take the Old Testament promises that God made to ancient Israel and try to apply them to America. It just doesn't work. That's why you've never heard me preach a sermon from 2 Chronicles 7:14. I've heard it used and abused so many times, I just stay away from it. The text says, if my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I'll hear from heaven and forgive their sins. That was absolutely true for the nation of Israel. It is not absolutely true for the United States of America. There may be a principle there about God's desire to forgive, but there's nothing there that says that God will restore our land. That was spoken to Israel. God had a specific, special relationship with them. And that's why it's significant that it says that she heard that the Lord had visited his people. Now, as his people, he had made certain agreements with them. And that's where the first verse becomes so significant, because it starts out telling us, came to pass when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. That tells you right off the bat that God is dealing with his covenant people. The reason there would be a famine is because the people had strayed away from God. Remember that before they even took the land, God gave them blessings and curses. He said, if you walk with me, I will bless you. I'll send the rain in its time. You'll have bumper crops. Life will be good. But if you do not follow me, you turn away from me and follow other gods, I will withhold the rain, you'll suffer famine. And the fact that this is God's covenant people and there's a famine in the land tells you something about what's going on spiritually in the nation of Israel at this time. Now, I've told you the events of the book of Ruth happened during the time of the judges. And I've told you that the book of Judges has a series of cycles in it. The cycle goes like this. Israel walks with God, God blesses them. Then Israel sins. God punishes them. They repent. God forgives them and restores them, and they walk with God. And it happens 7 times in the book of Judges, cycle after cycle after cycle. It appears that where we are in that cycle in this story is they had sinned. God has judged them with a famine. I guess that's somewhere down here. Apparently, they've cried out to him, and God has forgiven them, and now God is visiting them again. This is God's loving kindness. They had wandered away from God, and they had no right to expect anything from him. And the God from whom they had no right to expect anything steps in and visits his people. That's the loving kindness of God. You see it again at the end of verse 6, where it says that he visited his people in giving them bread. Where there's been a famine, now God is providing bread for them. Now remember, this story is centered in Bethlehem. And the name Bethlehem means house of bread. It's just ironic that the house of bread couldn't feed its own people, wasn't it? But now God has visited them again, and the house of bread is now living up to its name. It's a house of bread. It's a place where there's plenty. It's a place where there's now food. And by the way, just as a point of interest, the last part of verse 6 in the Hebrew is kind of a playful expression in giving them bread. If you were to say it in the Hebrew, it would sound something like this. Latet lahem lahem. That just kind of has a bounce to it, doesn't it? Latet lahem lahem. God has provided bread again. He's visited his people. This is a celebration. This is a happy time. That's the loving kindness of God. That's God's hesed. They had no right to expect anything. God, though, has provided for them. You see God's kindness in the fact that he visited his people, in the fact that he's provided bread for them again. And then I see God's loving kindness in the fact that Naomi has come to know about what God is doing in Bethlehem. You remember the story, Naomi walked out. Things got hard, and she and Elimelech packed their bags, and of her own volition, she moved out of the land of promise and into the land of Moab. And she was really wandering away from God when she did that. And you got to remember, this is 1,000 years before Christ. No one could text her or message her or Twitter her to say, hey, there's food in Bethlehem again. This was long before the printing press. They didn't have technology like we have it. And you know, it's conceivable she could have lived out her days in Moab without ever hearing about what God was doing in Bethlehem. So how did she know? The text doesn't say. Probably by word of mouth, but I see in that God's kindness, because God in his hesed, God in his love, his grace, his mercy, his generosity is going to work to bring her back to himself again. So there in that distant land of Moab, she gets word that God has visited his people. There's food available in Bethlehem. And he stirs her heart to want to come back home again. That's the loving kindness of God. Maybe he's stirring your heart that same way today. Let's see how Naomi responds to the loving kindness of God. I'm reading verse 6. I'm going to read it from the King James just because that's what I carry with me, but I'm going to point out three words that are significant. Verse 6 says, she arose. That's the first word. She arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return. That's the second word. She arose to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people and giving them bread. Wherefore she went forth. She arose to return, and she went forth. Some have compared this passage to the story of the prodigal son, and I think it's an apt comparison. The prodigal son left home and went into the far country. Elimelech and Naomi left Bethlehem and went into the far country. The prodigal son wasted everything that he had. Naomi lost everything that she had. She lost her husband. She lost her sons. The prodigal son heard that there was bread back home. Naomi heard that there was bread back home. The prodigal son arose and went back home. Naomi now will arise and go back home. That's her response to the hesed, the loving kindness of God. It's a proper response, isn't it? So we see the loving kindness of God. We see the response of Naomi. And now that creates a dilemma for her daughters-in-law. And the dilemma is this. If Naomi goes back to Bethlehem, what happens to us? Now remember, they had married her two sons. Ruth was married to Mahlon, and Orpah was married to Chilion. And they'd been married for 10 years. Now in that culture, typically, when a woman married a man, she moved into the household of that man's family. Sometimes they would add on to the house, but it's not like they left home and set up house someplace else. I mean, this is just how it was done in that culture in that time. So these women had left their home. They had moved into the home of Naomi and her sons. And now the sons are gone. And now they're living with Naomi, apparently dependent upon her to provide for them. Now, if she goes back to Bethlehem, what happens to them? Now, it kind of fascinates me that the discussion about that question takes place on the road. Look at verse 7. Wherefore she, that is Naomi, went forth out of the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. They went on the way to return to the land of Judah. See, what it doesn't tell us is whether she said, girls, let's go to Judah. And they came along. Or whether she just started out and they're following. I don't know. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, that's verse 8, go, return, each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you as you've dealt with the dead and with me. If you'd been on that road to Judah that day, you might have seen these three women walking initially very quietly along the road. One of them probably looking agitated and disturbed, that would be Naomi. The other is looking curious and wondering what's going on. Maybe even Naomi's lips were moving as she was trying to figure out, how am I going to tell these girls to go back home? Maybe she was practicing it along the way. Initially, they were quiet, and all of a sudden, she stops in her tracks. She turns to the girls. These are the first words from Naomi in the book, by the way. She breaks the silence with a double command. Go! Return! You kind of see her shooing them off. Return to your own homes. It was probably just as abrupt as it sounded. See, Naomi was going home. Bethlehem was her home. These girls had no ties to Bethlehem. Probably never stepped foot in the place. Oh, surely they'd heard a lot about Bethlehem over the years, but that wasn't their home. Their home was Moab. So girls, go home. Then she gives them a twofold blessing. Notice what she says in verse 8. She says, middle of the verse, the Lord deal kindly with you as you've dealt with the dead and with me. Now that phrase, deal kindly, translates our word hesed. So what she's saying is, may God, who owes you nothing, from whom you have the right to expect nothing, may this God deal with you with grace and love and kindness and all of these things. Now think about the implications of that for a moment. These girls did not grow up serving Israel's God. By the way, if you look at the word Lord there in verse 8, notice it's all capital letters. And that's just the translator's way of saying this is translating the covenant name for God. It's Yahweh or Jehovah. We don't know which because there are no vowels in the Hebrew. So it could be either one of those. But this is the covenant God of Israel. And she says, my prayer is that my God, the covenant God, would extend his hesed to you. These girls are idolaters from Moab. We know something about Moab's god. Moab worshipped a god named Chemosh, otherwise known as the fish god. And in Moab, they sometimes worshipped their god by offering human sacrifices to him. Can you imagine such a thing? Years ago, I visited Mexico City, Mexico, and I don't know, 10, 15 miles outside of the city, there's some pyramids. They say these pyramids rival the pyramids of Egypt. Which I've not seen those, but they were pretty massive, pretty impressive. And along the side, they've carved in a stairway to go to the top. The stairs are steep and they're irregular and has you huffing and puffing before you get to the top, but it's quite a view when you get up there. The ancient civilization that built these pyramids is kind of a mystery. They don't know much about them, and they don't know what happened to them. They just disappeared. Which is really fascinating to me. But they left enough behind that we know that they sometimes offered human sacrifices. And the pyramids are where they offered the sacrifices. They would drag the victim to the top of the pyramid where the priest would meet them, cut open their chest and pull out their heart while it's still beating and hold it up to their god. And then they had a vessel, they called it a chakmul, and they put the heart beating in that chakmul, and then they would throw the body on the backside of the pyramid. And that's how they worshiped their god. Absolutely disgusting. Inconceivable. That's what they did in Moab. These girls were Moabites. How could Naomi, in good conscience, ask Jehovah, the covenant God of Israel, to bless these idolatrous girls? I think the answer is twofold. First, she knew that her God was a God of Hesed. That the one from whom we have the right to expect nothing is longing to give us everything. And he could bless even these Moabite girls. And the second thing is, she says, I want God to bless you like you have blessed me. And she's simply asking that God would repay them in kind. Now, I said she gives a twofold blessing. The first is she asks that God would extend his hesed to them. The second is, well, notice the end of verse 9. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband. Now, wait a minute. These girls have husbands? No, their husbands are dead. What she's praying here is that God will give them new husbands. Now, what you need to understand that is that in this culture, women were very, very dependent upon men. And I know in our culture that just rankles and people don't like it and that's sexist and all that jazz. I really don't care about that stuff. The reality is, at this point in time and in this geographical location, a woman without a man was in desperate straits. They were dependent upon their husbands to take care of them. And especially widows were in desperate straits. And so what's happening is Naomi is simply praying that God would provide for them, that they would have husbands again. Now, in the middle of verse 9, then she kissed them. They lifted up their voice and they wept. It's kind of a tender scene, the breaking up of this little family. And they said to her, surely we'll return with you to your people. Naomi said, turn again, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters. Go your way. I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband also tonight and should also bear sons, would you tarry for them till they were grown? Would you stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, it grieves me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Now, these verses bring me to my primary message. what I want to communicate from this text. See, initially, both girls said they would go with her. That's verse 10. He said, surely we'll return with you to your people. What Naomi knew was that such a return would be very costly for these girls. And so what she's doing is she's telling them, you really need to count the costs. It's going to cost you a lot if you go to Bethlehem with me. Let me show you three reasons why it would be a costly choice. First, they would be leaving everything they knew behind. They would not just be moving down the street or across town. They would be moving out of the country where they had grown up. They would be moving away from the God that they worship. They would be leaving their family. They would be going to a whole different place, a whole different culture. They would leave all behind if they went to Bethlehem. So think about this, girls. Are you really prepared to leave everything behind to follow me? Second thing is that there is no way that these girls could expect to find husbands in Israel because they were Moabite women. What Naomi knows is that no upstanding, God-fearing Jew is going to marry you if you come to Israel. See, the reality is that the Moabites and Israelites in that day got along about as well as the Israelites and the Samaritans of Jesus' day. You remember the story of the woman at the well, John chapter 4? She says to Jesus, how is it that you, being a Jew, speak to me, who am a Samaritan? She says, the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. The same could be said about the Moabites in Naomi's day. One writer says these girls would be about as welcome in Bethlehem as a ham sandwich at a bar mitzvah, and I think they pretty well captured it. If they go to Israel, they're going to be seen as godless, foreign women. What decent Jewish man would want to marry a godless, foreign woman from Moab? Going with Naomi would be costly because they'd really be locking themselves into perpetual widowhood. They would be leaving everything they knew behind. They would be locking themselves into their widowed state. And third, they would lock themselves in with Naomi's misfortunes. Listen to the bitterness as she finishes this speech in verse 13. She says, it grieves me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. She's become bitter. And they're going to lock themselves in with her bitterness. Let's step back from the story a minute. Let me just ask you a question. From a spiritual perspective, which would be better for these girls? To be in Israel with Israel's God, or to be in Moab with Moab's God? Now, that shouldn't be a hard question. Which is best? Well, obviously in Israel, because it's in Israel that they'll know God. That's where God is. Now, I understand God is also in Moab, but not in the same sense he's in Israel. It was there that God had revealed himself to his covenant people, and it was there that they could really know this God. So they're really the crossroads, aren't they? They can stay home and continue to worship their God, Chemosh, or they can leave all that behind, and they can go with Naomi and maybe get to know her God, Jehovah. One writer put that choice in the form of an equation. He said they could have Jehovah plus nothing in Bethlehem, or they could have everything minus Jehovah in Moab. Well, that kind of sounds familiar, doesn't it? Because that choice is still available today. You can have Jehovah, the covenant God, with no promise of anything else in this life but him. Or you can pursue the things of this world without him. That choice really hasn't changed, has it? Jesus challenged his disciples to count the costs. One day when a crowd of people were following him, he turned to them and he said this, whoever does not carry his own cross... And by the way, the cross is an instrument of death, right? I mean, you don't carry your own cross. You got to be willing to lose it all, to die to your way of life, to die to your aspirations, to die to what you thought was important. Whoever does not carry his own cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. For which of you wanting to build a tower doesn't sit down first and compute the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? Otherwise, when he's laid the foundations, not able to finish the tower, all who see it will begin to make fun of him. They'll say, this man began to build and was not able to finish. In the same way, therefore, not one of you can be my disciple if he does not renounce all of his possessions. What he's saying is, you want to follow me? You count the cost. It's going to cost you to follow me. That's what Naomi was saying to her daughters-in-law, wasn't it? You can follow me, but it's going to be costly. Let's see what happened. Verse 14. They lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law and walked out of the pages of Scripture, never to be heard from again. But Ruth clave to her mother-in-law, and Ruth began the adventure of her life. She made the right choice, didn't she? What about you? Have you counted the cost, and are you following Christ? Let's pray together, shall we? Father, I thank you for this wonderful story. Thank you for Ruth, that she was willing to give it all up to go to the place where she could find you. I pray we would follow her example, that we would count the cost and follow you with our whole hearts. For Jesus' sake and in his name, amen.